Thanks for listening to We Live Here, 10 years after the Ferguson uprising. If you like what you hear, we have more great content on our website, stlpr.org. While you're there, you can catch up on the news and listen to more podcasts like The Gateway, Politically Speaking, and St. Louis on the Air. We also have music. Listen to our classical and jazz streams along with archived episodes of The Next Set from Jazz St. Louis at stlpr.org.
In the weeks following Mike Brown's death, a group of protesters gathered in front of the Ferguson Police Department for what would become a regular occurrence in the coming days and months. The tension had reached a boiling point. Images from the protest and the uprising had made national and international news, showing officers using tear gas and rubber bullets against protesters. There were the nights of looting and fires that engulfed stores across Ferguson and the surrounding communities. On any given night, the department would become the rallying place for scores of protesters calling for reforms, justice for Mike Brown, and of course, for St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough to charge Darren Wilson. But it also became more than that. Because when groups of people come together for the same cause again and again, it's only natural that those people start talking to one another about the fight and other things. They develop bonds, they start organizing together, some started dating, and some became best friends. Many of those protesters would become regulars, returning to the department ready to be led or lead themselves. Two of those people were Kayla Reed and Brittany Packnett Cunningham. They recently caught up with each other because we wanted to hear more about their friendship. 10 years ago, Kayla was a 24-year-old pharmacy tech, but as a Black woman from North St. Louis County, Mike's killing, like so many others, galvanized her to head to the streets.
This was sort of immediately after a particular night of protest when the Ferguson police chief joined the protest, and there was sort of an all-out chaotic moment between the Ferguson PD and the protest community. Mm-hmm. And we called a meeting. I was like, we cannot, we have to be thinking about tactics and safety, planning and scale, because, you know, the numbers were dwindling from the original sort of first few weeks of the uprising.
Kayla held the meeting at a nearby church in Ferguson. People of all ages showed up to listen. At that same meeting was Brittany Packnett Cunningham, another Black woman from North County, also ready to make change. She came up to Kayla that night, asking how she could help. Kayla didn't really have an answer, but Brittany shared how they could utilize breakout groups, set the agenda for the meeting, and ushered her through the tough questions they would talk about throughout that meeting. Brittany was prepared and ready to lead at a moment's notice.
And so Brittany walks in with this huge, post-it note. And I was like, you just have that in your car? We get through this meeting and it is successful. The sort of makeup of an uprising is that there are a lot of personalities, there are a lot of people. There's no leader, there's no one person, everyone's a part of the same organization and there are rules of engagements and community agreements. You're figuring it out in real time. And we were able to struggle together as a community that night.
Brittany remembers this too, and she also remembers the energy Kayla brought into the meeting and subsequent ones. If Kayla hadn't been doing this for a long time, well, she certainly had Brittany fooled.
She must have been doing this for like 10, 20 years. She clearly knows what to do and, you know, where to get started. And we would find ourselves in church basements having organizing meetings, in my basement having organizing meetings, my mama's basement.
By the time October hit, and after seeing each other at protest and organizing meetups, Kayla and Brittany had become close friends. They grew together, bonded together. They shared life milestones with each other. Kayla was even at Brittany's wedding. But it all started on the streets of Ferguson.
It's this terrible, awful, kind of awe-inspiring blooming that we've all gone through. People, you know, amongst our group, people have discovered, you know, new things about their identity and their sexuality. People have found new callings. People have had children. Folks have moved states. People have created so much. And I think what I find such a blessing was to have not only been connected with people that I might not have been connected with otherwise,
right,
but to remain in connection.
At the end of the day, behind the smoke, fire, chants, and police violence, life didn't stop. Friendships and bonds came out of something awful. Over the next few years, Kayla would become an organizer with the Organization for Black Struggle and launch Action St. Louis, while Brittany was appointed to the Ferguson Commission, helped create Campaign Zero, and was a member of President Barack Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Their stories aren't too different from other activists who met in the streets and developed bonds. But so much was happening during the months and years that followed. There were wins, there were losses, there were even threats. Then, Brittany left. That's what Kayla and Brittany are talking about in this episode. I reached out to Kayla and asked if we could listen to them talk about why Brittany left and why Kayla stayed. So, what happens when you and your friend, doing much of the same work, are separated by hundreds of miles? How do you carry the memories of home and stay connected with your community? I'm Chad Davis, and this is We Live Here, 10 years after the Ferguson Uprising.
Hi, Brittany. How are you?
Hi, Boo. I'm good. How are you?
I am good. I am grateful to be having this conversation with you because, you know, it's a hard moment. It has been 10 years since Mike Brown was killed and the Ferguson Uprising happened, and 10 years since we embarked on this friendship journey that we've been in.
Yeah. I'm grateful to be talking to you, too. It's such an odd thing to have this moment of terror and despair and confusion and frustration and pain also mark the birth of some of the most important relationships in my life. And people that I have learned so much from, that I've grown with. We've experienced life milestones together. And it is somehow beautiful to know that community rose from those ashes, and that we were able to build bonds of joy and love in this fight that we're in.
You moved. And I still live here. But what does it mean to live in a different place when you're from another place, right? And, and how that still remains a version of home, even if it's not your residence. And so, you know, when did you move away? I remember this because I was, I remember when I got the news broken to me that you were moving away.
I moved away right at the top of 2017, and moved back to Washington, D.C., which is a place I had lived and worked before. I worked on Capitol Hill and I taught here and had a community here. What most people don't know about that chapter, which you well know, is that I was under some really intense personal threats that were coming from someone that I had grown up knowing and that easily had access to, like, myself, my family, my staff, our office, through a whole host of avenues. And, you know, at that point, Kayla, like, so many of us had been getting threats all the time. You get a threat when you get threats when you get off of TV, you get threats when you get off the radio. You get threats randomly in your email. You get threats in your mailbox at your house. You get threats texted to you. So sadly, this was a reality that all of us were living. And in the beginning, I didn't make much of it until I realized just how close this was.
Yeah.
And the more things started coming, I started thinking about
my own safety, my family's safety. This was kind of like the last quarter of 2016. So it's also like holiday season and you're trying to just be joyful and present, especially after like being in this uprising for 2 years, which had just taken so much energy and commitment. We just, you know, wanted to have some Black joy and have some peace and have, you know, peace and goodwill, like all people want during the holidays, like we're all supposed to get. And instead, I was interviewing bodyguards and had people with me 24 hours a day. I was not allowed to drive myself. We had to get to security for our office. I had to file a restraining order. Shout out to the Arch City Defenders who supported me throughout all of that, and Michael John Voss. And I found myself tired of having to fight with my arms tied behind my back. I don't think enough people talk about how hard it is to be Black in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Not because it's the hardest place to be Black in America necessarily, right? We know the stories of the Deep South, of Mississippi and Alabama, where so many of our elders and ancestors lived and our peers still live.
Yeah.
But in some ways, it was more challenging to be Black in St. Louis because it's papered over with Midwestern nice.
Yeah.
And because the terror looks different, because the isolation looks different, because the undermining can be underhanded, I don't think people understand how much it taxes Black folks, especially Black folks who are trying to make the region what it can be.
Yeah.
And it had come now fully to my doorstep. I mean, I literally started dating Reggie with my bodyguard driving us to the movies. And it's not like I could afford a bodyguard, but like somebody had to pay for that for me. And so in the end, when the opportunity came to take a national job and to press reset on some things for my own mental health and physical safety, I said yes. And it wasn't an easy yes, because I've always felt connected to St. Louis, but that was the deepest my connection had ever been. Not because our city was treating us particularly well, but because I kept seeing glimpses of what we could be.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And thank you for sharing such an incredibly vulnerable, you know, reality that you had to navigate. And
I mean, but it's incredibly vulnerable to stay, right?
Yeah.
To like know that everything I said is just as true for you as it was for me, right? Like I have the privilege of getting on the plane and coming back to DC. So what has made you stay rooted?
I was born here, grew up in North City, lived in North County, now live in South City. And I had never lived anyplace else. And so some of it was options, right? And newness that felt intimidating. And there is a truth that even in the chaos that ensued, it was more familiar than the strangeness of a new place. And, you know, there were job offers and, you know, school opportunities in other places. But I felt deeply called to stay on assignment on the ground. And I think like a lot of folks who sort of got a public persona, you know, and people define that differently, how many interviews you did on TV or how many people followed you on Twitter, you know, all that sort of like not really important metrics that people on you in the moment where there was an intersection of sort of notoriety and activism. I felt a lot of tension. I'm not going to lie. There was a lot of sort of, some of it was a traumatic response to prove that I wasn't a person who was interested in being a famous face or, you know, a national voice, that I wanted, you know, that was a part of it. But I think overwhelmingly what it was I felt on assignment to keep my feet on the ground here so that when folks came and asked what was different, I could have an answer. And that assignment has looked different. You know, it started off as me being an organizer at the Organization for Black Struggle, and then thinking I was going to sort of stop organizing and go back to school full time, and went back to school full time and kept organizing, and you know, sort of relaunched St. Louis Action Council in 2016 after Philando Castile and Alton Sterling were killed, and taking that activist collective through the journey of building an organization has kept me anchored here, because I just deeply feel that organizing is a local, project. It has to be. And even a national conversation has to be anchored inside of local examples and experiments. And I wanted to get really good at being an organizer, you know? Like, if this was going to be my assignment, if this was going to be my job, if this was going to be my role, I wanted to be undefeatable, you know? Like, we are from St. Louis, so as much as I, and St. Louis is like, we live in the show me state, right? It's a natural, you learn how to play, I learned how to play spades when I was in the third grade. I'm competitive, you know? And so for me, it was about being the very best at this thing, but also being the best that it wasn't about me. It was about how quickly and how effectively we could mitigate harm and bring structural change to communities that have been impacted. And, you know, my why was that my family, my working class family, still lived in these municipalities. They still lived in these neighborhoods. They still had to deal with these police. You know, they had to deal with the jails and the structure. They felt like their vote didn't matter, right? They were on the receiving end of rent prices increasing and education opportunities dwindling. And so I just felt like sort of all of those reasons, both the promise of what's possible, the anxiety of change, the grounding of my, like, the place that I'm from and the people I love being here overwhelmingly, made, you know, when certain choices came before me to think about leaving, I just didn't want to. It didn't feel necessary. And I just felt like, you know, my assignment was to be a strong organizer in St. Louis. And I have just spent the last 10 years really chasing that, to build the type, to be a part of the power building project that could change lives.
Do you think anything could ever entice you to leave? Because listen, some days I like want you to, like, even if you don't move, like, go on tour, because I'm like, I want everybody to have the blueprint of how y'all did it.
Yeah, and the thing is like, we didn't have a blueprint, right? And no uprising, you know, the sort of, and you know, I put this on social media the other day, that people sort of want this linear answers. You know, Mike Brown is killed in 2014. Y'all protest for a year and change, and the longest continual protest movement in America's history. What happens 10 years later? What is different? How does it change? What's the win? And it is just more nuanced than that. There are ebbs and flow. There are moments of progress. There are moments of, you know, resistance to that progress. And it's not like we have dormant opposition in St. Louis to the things that we want to see, right? And so they're recalibrating and thinking about how to respond to us. And we've had some substantial, you know, points of transformation, whether that is something, you know, like Arc City Defenders just released a 10-year report on the municipal policing. The sheer number of dollars that are extracted out of Black communities has dropped over 90% in 10 years. That is something to celebrate as an outcome to of the Ferguson uprising, right? The organizing that takes place after that, the institutions that get built after that, the capacity to challenge that gets built after that. But also, we still live in a region where we have, you know, over 60 municipalities and police departments, right? And they're still functioning inside of a structure that we, for 10 years, have tried to prove needs to not exist. Part of what I hope the last 10 years, at least, that people have looked at me, is to say, she has been an example of what it means to be committed to a project long term.
Yeah.
And it's not to say that the other work isn't important, because it all matters. You can be far, but what has always made me really grateful for you out beyond our friendship and inside of our like comrade relationship is that you are still very anchored in the what and how and why of St. Louis. You didn't leave and turn your back. You left and elevated when you could, how you could, where you could.
We'll be back after the break. And we're back. Being an activist or an organizer isn't like a typical job. You're not clocking in 9 to 5 or dealing with customers per se. It is a service job, but it's not a service job. You have people you're serving and aiding, but they're not paying customers. They're your neighbors, shop owners, family, and friends. You're working to make their lives better, and once you achieve that and reach that goal, you're kind of out of a job. And that's what makes this kind of job so different. Because that's the goal. Essentially, you're trying to put yourself out of business. And it's something Brittany has been pondering.
I want all of us to retire.
Yeah.
Not because we're old or we are tired or we're, you know, broken down and beaten up, but because the work is done.
Yeah.
Right? That we ultimately see this as not the work of our egos or the work of notoriety or the work even of history making, right? But rather the work of putting ourselves in retirement.
Yeah.
Of putting ourselves out of business.
Yeah.
If we do that, transformation doesn't come from terror so great that it steals the breath of life.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I was still living in St. Louis, but it was 2014, and I had come to D.C. for Congressional Black Caucus Week. I was leaving the big gala at the end of the week, and I was walking out to find an Uber. And I realized that the woman who had been walking in front of me was Mike's mom, Leslie McSpadden. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't met her at that point. And this was just a month later in September. But I touched her on the shoulder and I said, I hope you don't mind, but I'm a protester. I grew up in Florissant. I still live in St. Louis. And I want you to know we're fighting every day for your son. And I'm so sorry he's not still here. Because as somebody who had spent at that point a career in education, that the diploma that his mother sat there on TV the next day, that she and Mike and Mike Brown Sr. had worked together so hard for him to receive, I was so convicted because that degree, that diploma was not bulletproof. That it did not change the conditions in which he was living that rendered him a threat simply for existing. And that conviction drove me to new places. It drove me to fight with parts of myself I had been wanting to ignore. It drove me to securing power that I had been scared to hold for myself. But ultimately, it drove me to remember every single day that there was an empty seat at Leslie McSpadden's table.
Mm-hmm.
Every single day. And then no matter how much we sacrificed, no matter how much harm came our way, no matter how many ounces of tear gas we inhaled, no matter how much pepper spray was in our faces, no matter how many tanks we faced down, we did not have to go home to Michael's empty seat. So I just hope that we put ourselves out of business. And I hope that sooner rather than later, the things that transform the world those watershed moments that make everybody get up and move no longer have to include dead bodies.
Yeah. Amen to that, sister. Amen and ashe.
And yeah. I think that as my career has shifted, you know, I found myself having this interesting confluence during the Ferguson uprising where so many seemingly disparate experiences of my life, both professional and personal, seem to be coming together in a unique way. Like the first protest I ever organized, I was in elementary school and I wanted a Black Santa at the St. Louis Galleria. And sure enough, we got the signs and my daddy got his church members and my cousins and whatnot. We protested and the news came out. And I remember when we got a letter in the mail saying that they were going to start having Black Santas. And I, you know, and to fight for something that you believe in, even as seemingly silly as a Santa. But then when you're like 7, 8 years old, it's pretty transformative.
For sure.
For your outlook on the world and what your purpose is in it, in the way that they did at the time that they did. But what I realized was, especially as my career progressed, that I felt like my assignment, my calling was to help speak and teach truth to move people to action. Because the Ferguson uprising will forever be what it was because of everyday people who knew that they had some power in them to do something different.
Yeah. We say Mike Brown was killed and then there was a protest. But this was a protest that was met with a type of state violence.
That's right.
And intimidation and terror.
That's right.
That we had not seen in our lifetime.
That's right.
Or seen in a place
in our
like
generation.
St. Louis,
yeah.
In the middle of a suburban neighborhood, right? Like this Ferguson
That's
is
right.
a commute, it's a neighborhood.
Yeah.
My parents still live about a mile and a half from Canfield Green and have lived there for 30 years and raised their 5 children in that
Miss
house.
Miss Patrice used to braid my hair in at the apartment complex right next door every single month. I used to be sitting on the floor of her house while she sat on the couch and braided my hair, right? And like, yeah.
It just is.
Yeah.
So it makes something more real. I remember, you know, when X was Twitter, my bio said, you know, St. Louis made before the corporate entity took that hashtag over. And it said, everything I do is for Black people.
And I
found that reason and that clarity because in 2014, Black people decided to do whatever they could do for each other.
That's right.
If that meant feeding each other, if that meant watching out for each other's kids, if that meant standing in the middle of the street against a tank, if that meant taking a rest and possibly losing your job
and employing somebody who lost their job.
Yeah, like whatever it meant.
Whatever
it meant, folks showed up, right? Black people and their allies showed up in that moment. And my life's work is indebted to those people because all those people don't become Brittany Packnett Cunningham or Kayla Reed. They go back to live their lives, right?
That's
they go
right.
back to their jobs or and the hours. So it's my responsibility to think about how do we make life easier for the folks who made a decision and took risk their freedom, their lives, right? Their safety.
Yeah.
For something bigger than all of us. And
and
how do we honor the fact that Mike Brown walked home that day not knowing that he would become a martyr
for the
conversation on Black liberation, for the conversation around transformative justice, for a conversation around abolition, for a conversation around equity and transformation. And he didn't know that that was going to be, you know, there's the famous saying, like, they, you know, they didn't know that we were seeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the flowers that have bloomed out of the uprising and the people who continue to do that work, my dedication to those people, no matter where I am, for as long as I stay in St. Louis or anywhere else that I live, no matter what happens, I will honor those people with my hands, right?
Yes.
With my labor, with my heart.
That's right.
Because they deserve that.
Yeah. I think that time for me helped me find a voice I did not know I had. I used to joke that My father was a pastor. My mother is an ordained minister. My brother is a licensed preacher.
Yep.
And I was the only heathen in the group until I realized that, like, I realized justice is my ministry, yep. right? And that actually, if the front row seat I got to a masterclass in oration every single week, multiple times a week, from these beautiful Black people who would knit together faith and liberation for people who were desperately seeking it and always deserved it, that if that was the gift I had been given, then it's my responsibility not to be the voice for people, because nobody out here is voiceless, but to ensure that whenever I have the platform, the access, the audience, that I show up speaking in the prophetic ways that they require of me and taught me, right? That it is not that I am a prophet, but it's that every single person that we stood out there with is. And that the, like, helping metastasize those messages, I feel like is part of my duty, because what we stood together and fought for 10 years ago, and the ways that we did it, the ways we learned about ourselves and each other, the ways we had to confront our own internalized racism, white supremacy, patriarchy, heteronormativity, the ways that we had to evolve in order to keep up with the movement that not only we were using to move the city, but that was moving us.
Yep.
That all of that has to be a story told, mm-hmm. right? That all of that, and not just for the sake of history, but for the sake of action, mm-hmm. for somebody to hear that story and be able to see themselves in it in their own community, for their own issues,
yes.
Right where they are. And I just, I got so clear in that time that the revolution may not be televised, but it will be tweeted, it will be streamed, and there's a responsibility we have to use those tools of communication and narrative and storytelling to make sure people do their work.
What Ferguson, I hope 10 years later, reminds people is that everyday people can absolutely change the world, right? And as much as we have spent the last 10 years trying to be a part of a movement and change things, that very movement, those very communities have changed us. I just am completely transformed as a person who went from being sort of a 24-year-old working class wandering spirit to being solely and unequivocally anchored in a vision of the world that I want to see, a set of values that guide every decision that I make, and an accountability to this larger we and a community of people who didn't know that they were pouring into me while I was watching them, right? That I was finding my voice that allowed me to become who I am today. And so it is that St. Louis is such a beautifully complex place. And no matter where you go, right, you can't shake what St. Louis makes you become. Never and I just after. See it. You know, I see it. You know, you mentioned people like Jennifer Lewis and Maxine Waters and, you know, new age people like Jasmine Crockett,
Corey Bush.
Corey Bush. It's something so unique, you know, and these are, I am naming all Black women. So, I do want to point that out too. But like, there's something so specific about what it means to be from this soil. And no matter where you go, the lessons that you get while you're here, you take with you. And I'm just so, you know, I'm so grateful to have been a part of a moment like that. And I will always hate and will always be heartbroken that it took a life being snuffed out.
That's right.
And it just is my responsibility to live my life fully in service of a community and in honor of Michael Brown. and his family who have grieved out loud for a decade, who have had their lives put under a microscope for a decade, and who will now be asked the question, what is different?
Yeah.
And what is not different is that Mike Brown is gone.
That's right.
And so in honor of him, I feel like no matter if I'm here and 20 years later I'm someplace else, you know, I will always be concerned about the conditions of Black people in a place like St. Louis, because the conditions of Black people in a place like St. Louis are the conditions of Black people in a place like America.
That's right.
And if we are not measuring the advancement, the progress, the safety, the joy, the hope, the potential of Black people in a place like St. Louis, then we're never closer to a type of liberation that shatters oppression. We have talked for some time, and I just want to say it remains the honor of my life to work in service of a liberation that stops empty chairs, right? It is a complete honor, and I say that humbly. We used to always say, low ego,
high impact.
That has been a guiding principle for me. And I know it's been a guiding principle for you. And I'm just so grateful to know you. 10 years doesn't close the conversation. It's a metric and a moment to be reflective, to honor the work that has been done, and to recommit to the work that still remains. And I'm grateful to do that work alongside you, Brittany Packnett Cunningham.
Amen, Kayla Reed.
What Brittany and Kayla have isn't too unusual from most friends who spent years growing together. You become close, you share life moments, and then life hits. You have to move away or your friend moves away. Things change. Brittany and Kayla's friendship remained strong. They are tied by their mission, and hundreds of miles couldn't break that bond. And yes, I know we say Brittany left Ferguson, and she did in the literal sense. But if we really think about it, she didn't. She took Ferguson with her. Because in a lot of ways, Ferguson is everywhere. It's where there's injustice. It's where people are doing whatever they can to change policing. It's in the Baltimore, D.C. area, where Brittany moved to, and where Freddie Gray was killed in police custody years before. Kayla was right when she said flowers bloomed out of the uprising. Those flowers aren't just confined to reforms, a change in leadership, or get out the vote campaigns. It's these unbreakable bonds that have led people to make the change they are aiming for by supporting one another. Out of Ferguson, so many other activists became close to one another. And while it came out of a tragedy, the bonds were anything but that. I'm Chad Davis. This is We Live Here, 10 years after the Ferguson uprising.
This episode was produced by Chad Davis and edited by our executive producer, Chris Husted,
with production assistance from Danny Wisentowski and Emily Woodbury, and audio mixing and podcast design by Greg Montanu.
We received editorial guidance from Brian Heffernan.
Special thanks to Camille Stanley.
Financial support for this episode comes from the River City Journalism Fund.
Our theme music was inspired by Cassie Morgan and remixed by Mastermind. We Live Here is a production of St. Louis Public Radio in collaboration with the Midwest Newsroom. Thanks for listening.
Enjoying this season of We Live Here? Suggest us to a friend you think might like the podcast, and leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help new people discover the show. And thanks.